Okay, first of all, obviously everyone has a different house. Everyone has different appliances. Everyone has different plates and cutlery and minhagim. So, this is going to be an overview of the basic halachas. And I'm not going to claim that I'm an expert in every single material to kasher and things like that. So if you have a specific situation that you think is maybe relevant for other people also, so then feel free to jump in, raise your hand, and follow up with a question. If you have a specific situation that's only going to be for you because your dog has a certain diet and he sleeps in a certain way that might knock over the countertop, whatever, so then keep that for yourself, and then we can talk about it personally and not take any more time from this class for everyone else. Okay, let us get started. Cleaning for Pesach. So first of all, there's a big misnomer out there, and the misnomer is that you have to drive yourself crazy in order to be observant of Pesach. It's not true. It's the Chag HaChiras. It's the time where we're supposed to feel freedom. We're supposed to feel a sense of liberty. And it's not a time where we should be stressing out. Obviously, there are concerns and details and logistics that oftentimes, overwhelm us, especially as we get closer to the day. However, one of those things should not be cleaning. We should not be stressing out over cleaning. If you are, people have, their minhagim, and some people think it's a minhag to uproot every appliance they ever had and to take apart every couch and to go through every single page in every single book. That's not in any way an obligation. So what is the obligation? So generally, let's see if we have any Daf Yomi guys here. Jeff, I don't know if you did the beginning of the Masechta. You've been with us the last few weeks. Okay, so those who are listening on the recording that remember the beginning of Maseches Pesachim, right? The beginning of this, the current Masechta that we're doing, well, might remember a discussion about Bedikas Chametz. Bedikas Chametz, as we know, is the obligation, we'll talk about it a little bit next week, that you have to search for Chametz around the house. Why do you have to do that? There are two concerns when it comes to Chametz. Number one is eating Chametz. Well, there are other concerns, but let's just say in terms of having chametz in your house. Number one is eating chametz, and number two is owning chametz. Those are two separate concerns, and they manifest themselves in different ways. But for the sake of cleaning and for the sake of checking for chametz, so that is only relevant to the ownership of chametz. We'll get to a second why it might be connected to the eating, but there are two separate things that's important to realize. When it comes to eating chametz, even the smallest little crumb is a problem. You can't even eat the smallest little crumb, right? And that's why it's very important to clean. However, when it comes to owning chametz is only prohibited when it comes to an olive size, one piece of chametz, which is the size of an olive. Now, a little bigger than an olive, we're not going to get into measurements, but it has to be a real piece, right? One little crumb that you might be able to find in a book is not a transgression of owning chametz. Okay, so that means you do not have to move your refrigerator to toothpick the cracks in between your tiles. You don't have to do that. For two reasons. Number one, the size of the chametz is not probably big enough. And number two, more importantly, it's inaccessible. The only reason that we're concerned about smaller pieces of chametz, which are not as big of an olive, is lest you, number one, come to eat it. And I sort of skipped over a piece, which is that there are other pieces of chametz in your house, right? So let's say like this. We all have an obligation to get rid of our chametz. How do we get rid of our chametz? We hopefully get rid of the physical chametz, but some of us won't. Most of us won't, I would assume. We will not all get rid of our chametz. That comes to selling chametz, which we'll get to later. The way that we make sure that we're not going to be in violation of the biblical prohibition, the Isser Midarais, the biblical prohibition of having chametz, is by doing what's called bittul, right? Bittul is what we say, kol chamira v'chamia, right? When we check for chametz, or this year on Shabbos, we'll say the phrase, all of the chametz in my possession should be like dust and void, and it doesn't belong to me anymore, right? Everyone knows that phrase. But the rabbis tell us at the beginning of the Masechta, at the beginning of Pesachim, tell us that we're still concerned. On a biblical level, that takes care of it. But on a rabbinic level, rabbinically, we're still concerned for two things. Number one is maybe you weren't very sincere. You know, you have that piece of cake downstairs that you were loving. It was your birthday last week. It was your favorite cake. And, you know I said that it should be like dust and ashes and I shouldn't own it. But like, I really want that cake again. Maybe you sold it to a non-Jew, so it doesn't belong to you. But in reality, you really want it. So number one, says the Gemara, we are rabbinically still concerned about any other chametz you have in your house, because maybe you didn't wholeheartedly get rid of it, right? You didn't really mean it when you said, I don't want to own it anymore. That's concern number one. You didn't really mean it. And number two is, lest you come to actually eat it. Right? Maybe you're walking down, you know, you have like you have your little stash of snacks in a specific spot that technically you sold to the non-Jew. But whenever you pass that little snack pile, you'll take a handful and put it in your mouth. I don't know, whatever. Come up with your own idea. So for that concern, even though technically you sold it to the non-Jew, we're worried that habitually you're just going to pick it up and eat it. So that relates also to the cleaning, right? So in terms of cleaning, we want to make sure we don't have that problem. So number one, we're going to clean any visible parts of chametz. So for instance, when it comes to the chametz that you're going to sell, or that you've already authorized me to sell for those who have done it already, Hildy will talk later. I got your message. For those who are going to sell it to the non-Jew, really sell it. I don't mean quotation marks because it's not a real sale. I mean quotation marks because we haven't done the sale yet until next Friday. For those who are selling to the non-Jew, that doesn't mean you can just leave your chametz around. That means that you have to put your chametz in a specific spot, which is why on the forms that we have, even though in past forms of the Young Israel, they haven't specified where the chametz is going to be. When it comes to this year, you know, and the form that I'm comfortable with, so then what we're supposed to do is put it in a specific spot and block off that spot. Close it, lock it, tape it, whatever it is. You're not supposed to see it. You're not supposed to want to grab it. You're not supposed to open the cabinet in a way that you're habituated to. So that's number one. You want to put it away. And secondly, you want to make sure that any other chametz is gone from your house. So that could mean that even if you have even like one Cheerio, which is a smaller amount than what you'd be obligated for owning, it's still rabbinically prohibited to eat it, or it's biblically prohibited to eat it, but it's even rabbinically prohibited to have it laying around lest you come to eat it. So for that type of thing, we want to make sure that any visible chametz, you think of it this way, three conditions to cleaning your house. The only things you have to clean are if they meet this criteria. Number one, it's visible. Number two, it's accessible. And number three, it's edible. Okay? Visible, accessible, and edible. If you have a moldy piece of Cheerios that's visible, so then we're not concerned that you're going to eat that because that would be unhealthy. You should get rid of it for other reasons. But if you have, let's say you're worried, maybe there's a piece of bread underneath my refrigerator. I haven't touched my refrigerator in 10 years, but maybe there's a piece of bread. Rabbi, do I have to move my refrigerator? No, because if you haven't moved it in 10 years, you're not going to move it over Pesach. So you don't have to be concerned. Maybe now, if you know there's chametz there, so maybe you want to move it just in case, to make sure you get that measurement. As long as it's a measurement, you might still be obligated. But assuming you don't have that and you don't know about it, there's no requirement to go behind your refrigerator and find any chametz in that way. So what practically do you have to do? Walk around your house, maybe vacuum the carpet so you can pretend like you're doing something. But practically, you just walk around your house and look for chametz. You don't have to drive yourself crazy. Maybe you're concerned that if there are crumbs in the side of the couch, you might touch it. Fine. So then vacuum out your couch. And maybe you're concerned. And by the way, even though I'm telling you you're not obligated to, that doesn't mean you don't get a mitzvah for doing it, right? So if you want to vacuum the little crumbs off your carpet, you get a mitzvah for doing that. That's a praiseworthy thing to do. I'm just telling you, don't make that any obligation that you'd be stressing about, because that's going to be a problem. We don't want you to be stressed out for Pesach. Pesach is supposed to be, Yom Cheruseinu, the time where we're experiencing freedom and not experiencing stress. So that's number one in terms of cleaning. In terms of the bedika, we'll talk about that more in more detail on Thursday night. But suffice it to say that you should keep over some chametz. Don't get rid of all your chametz, and make sure you have some chametz that you can put out safely and carefully, so that you'll be able to burn, not burn it necessarily, but get rid of it on Shabbos day. We'll talk about Shabbos day next week, Erev Pesach. A lot of different details that go into that that aren't typical. So we'll talk about that next Wednesday night. In terms of the sale for chametz, so as you might have been aware, so the sale of chametz is going to take place in person this year. Last year we did it virtually, and I appointed a different rabbi who was doing so on behalf of a lot of rabbis. He always does it on behalf of a lot of rabbis. But this, it's always better to do it in person. So I'll be doing it in person this year in conjunction with Rabbi Morris. And hopefully we'll take care of that on Friday afternoon. The reason we're doing it on Friday afternoon is to make sure that if anybody, there is generally a question whether you should always do it in the morning like you do other years. Suffice it to say, we're trying to cover our bases just in case somebody goes to the bakery on Friday morning or Friday noontime and says, oh, this looks like it's a good piece of chametz for Shabbos. We'll have it for dessert, whatever. We don't want that person to have not put that on their chametz form, to have not included that in their chametz, and then forgets to eat it on Shabbos. And that would be a problem because it won't be included in the sale if we did it earlier. And it won't be eaten on Shabbos, so that it could be a problem. Okay, but we'll get to next week. But suffice it to say, we're going to be doing the sale on Friday afternoon. We'll buy it back about an hour after Yontif, as we usually do. And we'll talk more of those details later. Now that we've gotten past the cleaning part, and the cleaning, you do have to go around your house, and you do have to check the rooms, you do have to clean out any possible places where there's chametz. I should say, and this could be a difference between people with kids, people without kids. You're only required to clean out those rooms that have a possibility of having chametz in them. If you're the type of people that would never, ever eat in your bedroom, so then you don't have to check your bedroom, right? If you're the type of person, and you shouldn't, halachically, you're not supposed to eat in your bathrooms, so then you don't have to check your bathrooms. Whether that means cleaning the bathrooms before Pesach or that means doing bedika, on Thursday night next week, you don't have to check them. They're just, we can assume based on a chazaka, there's no chametz in there. And that includes any room that you're sort of very adamant to not bring chametz into. If, however, you have kids, and those kids like to walk around with schmutz on their hands, or with actual cookies in their hands, and sometimes they'll take that into the bathroom, sometimes they'll take that into the bedroom, sometimes they'll take that into the basement, whatever it is. So you have a little more work cut out for you. But being that you have kids, you're used to having more work cut out for you. So hopefully you'll be able to manage this also. Go around the house, look for bigger pieces of chametz, and just look for it. You can move light furniture around, but if it's the type of furniture you never move, so then you don't have to worry about that, just like in your kitchen. I'm trying to remember if there's anything else that we should think about for cleaning. I think that's it. I might come up with something else. But let's move on. Now that we've cleaned, let's move on to koshering. And once we're going to talk about koshering, we might as well talk about toveling first. So koshering is very complicated. And one of the ways that we can introduce it is by talking about the materials that you have to do tefillah. Let's look, and I've thought a lot about how to present this because a lot of people get confused and a lot of people ask simple questions, a lot of people ask complicated questions. Think about it like this. Some materials absorb and some materials don't absorb, right? If you have a metal material, that's going to absorb. And it's going to absorb and it's going to expunge. Right? It can take things in and bring things out. Some materials can take things in but don't take things out. We'll call that like earthenware, like clay materials, and potentially glass, although glass gets very complicated. When it comes to tevilah, when it comes to putting things in a mikvah, so the items that you have to put in the mikvah happen to also be the same items that you can kasher. Okay? So for instance, when it comes to generally, when it comes to the mitzvah of tefillas kelim, of putting your utensils into a mikvah in order to make them usable. So what are the conditions to that? When it comes to tefillah, so it's learned out from a pasuk. This is an explicit pasuk in the Torah. This is not some kind of rabbinic thing where we're trying to get rid of all the little pieces of chametz. No, this is a midaraisa, biblical obligation. There are some smaller shitas that think otherwise, but we treat it as if it's a biblical obligation. There's a question whether it's a positive obligation or a negative obligation, or an isra ase. Not going to get into that. But suffice it to say, it's learned out from a pasuk. After the Jewish people in Bamidbar, after they defeat the Midian nation, right, and they take all of their spoils. So they take, it's an interesting question, if you remember, my kasha on the parsha last year was exactly this. Why is it that we learn it from Midian and not from other times that we defeated enemies and collected their spoils for a different time? But when it comes to the clay Midian, so it says explicitly in the pasuk, it says, let me see for a second. This is in Bamidbar. I think it's Yud Beis. Let me see if I have it in my notes. Bamidbar Lamed Aleph Chaf Beis. So if you go to that scene, so it says it explicitly in the pasuk. What are the materials? Right? I think people think that like this is a complicated thing. It's in explicitly in the pasuk. The pasuk says Lamed Aleph Chaf Beis in Bamidbar. Ach as Hazahav Kasef Nechoshes Barzel Bedil Ofares. What does that translate to? That translates the gold to copper, to silver, to copper, to iron, to tin, and to lead, i.e. any metal material. Now, there are new modern forms of metal that we treat like these materials, because we generally say that anything, as the next pasuk says, kol davar sheyavo ba'esh, anything which is fired in order to create it, right? So metal materials are usually created that way. So anything like that, those are the things that have to be toveled. So, you're going to ask me two things. You're going to ask me, what about glass? And you're going to ask me, what about plastic? Plastic, no. Glass, yes. There are discussions around glass, and it's not chayv midaraisa. It is not, we do not assume that it's included in one of these materials, but it is nonetheless included in order to make it kosher. So, if you buy something which is glass, for the sake of Pesach, or for the sake of anything for that matter, and you buy it from a non-Jew, you have to tovel that. You even tovel that with a bracha. That is included in the mitzvah. Anything metal, obviously. So then your next question is going to be, what if something is metal, but it has electricity involved? Like my hot water urn. Or my, I guess a sandwich maker would not be something you're using on Pesach. But what about my, my blender that doesn't detach for some reason? Whatever, you can come up with different types of electrical appliances that have metal. So if through toveling it, it will break. If through toveling it, it will break. So then we can be lenient to allow you not to tovel it. Some will tell you that you have to try, and if it breaks, it breaks. And some will tell you that if it's going to break, so then that means it's not the type of thing that you would be obligated to do it. So that's how we can be lenient for that. If you have a question about that, so ask me. Sometimes water urns, and I've actually done this, I have broken water urns trying to tovel them. So you have to always be careful about what kind of water urn you have. I've bought water urns that when you open the package, it says, if you dip this in water and you break it, you void the warranty. Right, because these people know the Jews well. But either way, so that's for electrical appliances. Now, what type of item requires tevila? So let's say you just bought a nice metal container to hold your spoons. Does that require you to dump it in the mikvah? The rule of thumb is, if it touches food, then it goes in the mikvah. If it doesn't touch food, you're not planning for it to touch food, which is important. You're not planning for it to touch food, so then it does not need to go in the mikvah. So one of the litmus tests of this rule is a can opener. What do we think about a can opener? Does a can opener have to go in the mikvah? if you're doing other things, so you might as well. But technically, it does not require it. And therefore, if you were to put in the mikvah, don't say a bracha if you're doing that all by its own. But technically, you're not planning to use this in contact with food. It might happen to touch food, but because you're not planning to use it, it's not considered what we call klei seuda, in which case it is not categorically, not just practically, but categorically, it's not included in the obligation to do tzvila. Let's see what else. When it comes to tzvila, as opposed to kashering, which we'll get in a second, when it comes to tzvila, you have to put the whole thing in at once. This gets a little tricky, and you have to be very careful. I'm sure people have looked at a mikveh and seen all of the lost kalim of everyone who's gone to the mikveh recently, right? The spoons and the forks and the bowls that people tried to put in the mikveh and then they didn't hold on to. Thankfully, here in Detroit, if you go to the Kalem mikveh here, so they have these nice big baskets that will catch it so that that you can put it in and it won't be a problem. But you have to make sure that when you put it in, you're going to have an instance where the entire thing is completely enveloped, right? Because if you put it on the grate, let's say you put it on the basket, and then you're gonna lower that basket into the water slowly. So it could very well be that the bottom, which is sitting on the grate, it has a chatzitza, it has something blocking the water from getting into it. So you don't want to do it that slowly. You want to put the basket a little bit into the water and then drop the item over where the basket is. And in that way, there will be a moment where the entire item is enveloped by water on all sides. Important to remember before you do that, to remove all stickers and all labels. This is one of the most common shilas I get after someone goes to the mikveh. I didn't take the labels off. What do I do now? If that happens, it's not necessarily the case. You have to do it again. Call me and we can talk about what the situation is. So that's it. Take the labels off. Take the stickers off. Make sure the whole item gets enveloped by the water and thereby it'll be good. Glass, anything metal. I should say this, although it's hard to answer these shilas without seeing the item specifically. If something is earthenware, because it's different from metal and glass, so because it's earthenware, technically you do not have to put it in the mikveh. However, many earthenware vessels nowadays are covered with some kind of glass coating. That's a machlokas haposkim, whether or not it requires tefillah. And generally, depending on the item. So for instance, people hopefully know what I'm talking about, but if you get a mug, right, very rarely will you get a mug and it's not smooth and glazed with something on the outside, right? It's not, you know, you can feel clay, you can feel that the roughness of the clay, of the earthenware, if you get a mug like that. Most likely you don't get that because that, you know, it's just not, it gets dirty and everything. So if it has one of those glazes on it, better to put it in the mikveh after you put something else in the mikveh. But technically, you can be lenient, especially if you don't have to make another trip, and that would be a schlep for you. So you can be lenient if you need to. If it's an earthenware vessel, if it's a clay vessel like a mug or something like that, you would not have to bring it to the mikveh, but better to do it along with something else that is requiring tefillah. In terms of COVID, by the way, last year we were discouraging people from going to the mikveh, not only because of the water, which, as I was about to say, is not a concern, but also because of the popularity of going there and the people that go there, and it's a small room, and who knows about the precautions people are taking. Make sure that you go at a time where there are not that many people there. Earlier the better. Earlier in the day the better. Later in the day the better. Actually, earlier in the day better. People usually push things off until late at night anyway. So you know, suffice it to say, you can make it work safely and with proper precautions, as we just mentioned, doing all these different things to make sure you get the whole water on the whole thing. If anyone has any specific questions about that, you bought something from Israel, maybe it's not, you know, a non-Jewish item, maybe it's electrical, maybe it's, you know, partly glass, partly this, partly that, the handles, the whole thing, so you can ask me a question about your specific situation. So that is tzvila. Let's move to prayer. Anyone have any questions? Anything that they've already come across that maybe fits or doesn't fit with what I've talked about already? In terms of cleaning, in terms of checking, in terms of dipping, am I just being so thorough that anyone can't even can't even come up with anything.
Plastic didn't have to be toy-filled.
Yeah, plastic does not have to be toy-filled, yeah. However, many...
Melamine is stuff that you use like flakes.
Melamine? I don't know if I know what that is, but let me check. You mean like Curel? Curel?
No, it's a type of plastic melamine.
Let me see.
But for plates, no.
Right.
Ask you, Bobby, melamine is plastic.
Melamine?
It's not called melamine here. It's called Melmac or something. What is this? There's a different word for it.
Okay.
But it's the hard plastic plates.
If it's plastic, it does not require. But let me see if they have it here in the...
It's just a very hard plastic. Yeah, it doesn't look like plastic.
So maybe I'll have to look into it. Is there a different name of it? Because it's not even on the list from the CRC. So if there's another name that you can think of, so let me know and I can look at it. But I don't see here. I don't see here what would be included. Hold on. Different list. Yeah, I don't see anything, so you'll have to let me know if you find another name for it.
Melmac is what it's called here.
Okay, I'll have to look it up later. So,
Google will show it.
Okay.
You write to Amazon.
Okay. Alrighty, moving on to koshering. Hold on, I think I see a hand from Jennifer and Saul.
You're going to talk koshering?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just about how to do like bafars.
Okay, yeah. Okay, let's get to that.
Okay, thanks.
Let's get to that now. So, okay, koshering. There are different types of koshering. I don't know if people got the OU guide. You can actually get this online. Many people get it to their house with a Jewish Action. The shul has a couple copies. They have a wonderful little diagram here for people that that could be helpful for this. Here is a little diagram here. This is a picture of a kitchen with a bunch of different types of appliances and how one should kosher it. Okay? If you want, the CRC also has similar charts and similar diagrams, strategies of how to kosher things. Overall, let's give an overview of these things. There are four kinds of koshering, but there's one general rule. The general rule is that whatever way something absorbs an item, something could absorb a taste, that's how you have to get rid of the taste. So for instance, your oven would absorb kosher or non-kosher foods. It would absorb that material by cooking, right? And cooking it at very high temperatures. Therefore, in order to kosher it, you also have to cook in it at very high temperatures. So there are four types of koshering that are reflective of the type of item. But let's go through the four types first. There's what's called libun gamor. Libun gamor is a very, very high level of heat. This is basically like a blowtorch. You're literally putting fire on something. There is a modern form of this, which we'll talk about in a second. Number two would be libun kal, which is high heat, but not necessarily super high heat, but good enough that we'll talk about when you can apply it. There is hagala. Hagala is pouring boiling water, right? This is the one that you might be familiar with for countertops. We'll get to that in a second. And then there's iroi kli rishon. Iroi kli rishon is also something that maybe you're familiar with, which is a different level of, but nonetheless similar thing to hagala, where the hagala is where you're putting something in the water, and the iroi kli rishon is where you're putting the water on the thing. Okay, so now let's apply these different things. Okay, so number one, let's talk ovens. Most people have two different types of ovens. There's the oven that has a self-clean cycle, and there's the oven that doesn't have a self-clean cycle. For the purposes of koshering, let's assume that there are no other fancy types of materials. Most ovens are made of some kind of metallic, so it's okay. when it comes to koshering it, if you have an oven which is safe to self-clean, which doesn't necessarily mean all ovens that have a self-clean function. You know, when we moved to Kansas, we had an oven that had a self-clean. We put the self-clean on and it broke the oven. Because it was an older oven. You've done that too, Adina. So, you know, experienced, you know, oven cleaners might be familiar with this phenomenon, especially with early versions of self-clean ovens. They typically couldn't stand the heat for that long, even though it was a feature on the thing. Imagine that. They created something that couldn't work. But if you have a competent self-clean oven, so then it's very simple. You have to just put the self-clean oven, self-clean cycle on. There are sort of nuances to this, especially when it comes to the door. When you open the oven door and you're going to put on the self-clean oven, you're going to close the door, and the inside of the door, right, the plate, the facing that hits against the inside, right? So there's the big hole. So that part's exposed to the fire. But then there are some parts that are still connected to the inside of the oven, which aren't going to be completely exposed to the fire. Those parts should be wiped down very clean and wiped down as much as possible. Oftentimes, you can't get the whole thing clean. What you should do is two or three times you should scrub it with, you know, Easy Off or Mr. Clean, whatever you use, your favorite thing of choice, and try to scrub it clean as much as possible. You do what you can. If it's not coming off like that, so then you don't have to worry about it any more than that. Make sure, another thing to realize, is the rubber, I don't know what you call it, the gasket or the rubber, I don't know if it's rubber, the lining on the side around the glass, oftentimes there could be stuff stuck in there. That also might not be connected because, again, that's going to be pushing against the front of the faceplate of the oven, and therefore it might not be able to be exposed to the fire in the same way. However, when it comes to self-cleaning cycles, you do not have to scrape and scrub every inch of your oven. That is something that will be taken care of, trust me, by the self-clean oven, assuming that your self-clean cycle gets up to whatever it is, 850 degrees. So that will all be burned out based, you know, when you do the self-clean cycle. And even, by the way, if you look in the oven afterwards and you see schmutz in there that still looks like something, it's in no way edible. After going through 880 degrees, nobody, not even the most disgusting dog, is not going to want to eat that. And therefore, it's not a problem. There are those people who don't have a self-clean oven or have a self-clean oven that they're worried is going to break if they put the self-clean cycle on. So what do those people do? So for them, for that situation, what you would want to do is to put your oven, well, first of all, you got to clean your oven, right? That you have to make sure there's no schmutz anywhere, because we cannot guarantee that when you put your oven on 550 degrees that it's going to burn it out to make it inedible. You know, you like to think that, but it's not necessarily the case, especially if there's going to be literal invisible pieces of something. So in that case, you want to burn your oven out for about, I think it's a half an hour at 550 degrees. Let me just see for a second. Non-self-cleaning oven, I think they say, here it says 60 minutes. Yeah. So about 60 minutes on the highest heat. That's what it says here for Pesach. For other things, maybe I'll be a little more lenient. But for 60 minutes, it's better if you were to also, similar to your sink, to clean it out and then wait 24 hours. This 24-hour thing, which we're going to say here by the oven and also by the sink, is in order to make it what's called eino ben yomo. When something is eino ben yomo, it's therefore a lesser degree of real food. It's considered to already be somewhat, you know, stale at that point, in which case it's more lenient. So when it comes to the self-cleaning cycle, you don't have to do that, because that's a libun gamor. That's like blow-torching your oven. For that, you don't have to do anything particularly significant in terms of cleaning. If you have like challah in there, maybe you want to take it. So when it comes to a non self cleaning oven, so then you're gonna want to scrub it, wait 24 hours, so that it's eno ben yom, or whatever's left in there, and then you're gonna do the 550, put the oven on 550 for an hour, and that should take care of it. When you do this, and this is also something maybe you have to know about your oven, you want to keep the racks in. Keep the racks in, because the racks will also be kashered through the same process. You also want to clean the racks. You want to scrub those down. If it's a self-clean, again, self-clean, you don't have to clean it beforehand. You can just put it in and it'll burn off. What else can you put in your oven? Trivia question. What else can you put in your oven to help with the kashering process? Anyone know?
The grates.
Moshe might have been saying that also. The grates on top of your stove. This does not matter. Well, it sort of matters, because I don't think you can take off electrical grates. But if you have removable grates and you want to kosher them, you can do so by putting them inside the oven. There are some ovens will tell you not to do that. Some kosher agencies will tell you not to do that. I've actually, in looking about what different kosher agencies recommend, some people say to do it, some people say not to do it. Even the kosher agencies will tell you that it's not a good thing for the oven. I've done it. My oven's okay with it. But you have to know your oven. You have to know your oven well, if it's newer, if it's older, if it's well used, whatever. But that's another way you can kosher your grates.
It's also not too good for the grates or for the racks to put them in the oven.
Yeah, that could be. And the racks oftentimes will discolor, and the grates will sometimes lose the coating, right? Exactly. The grates sometimes will lose that particularly.
What keeps them from getting smutsy every time you cook?
Right. So it's a trade-off. Getting rid of the schmutz for Pesach, or living with schmutz for the rest of your life.
Extra grates when we got a new one.
Okay, so some people will have extra grates because they're extra fancy, and that will take care of all problems. Similarly to that question is also dishwashers. Dishwashers, although the tide might be turning in terms of what you're able to do with dishwashers, we assume that you cannot kosher a dishwasher unless it's entirely metal. Most dishwashers nowadays are not, unless, you're a fancy person and you have a completely metal dishwasher. So that we can talk later, but assuming you don't have one, so then you should make your spouse wash the dishes. That's the solution. That's ovens. That's ovens. What about stovetops? So a stovetop can be, let's say you don't want to put it inside the oven, right? You're worried about the coating. You're worried about what's going to happen with that. So you're going to want to put on the fire for about 40 minutes worth. You have to clean it. And then typically what we'll say is that you have to get the grates to be red hot. That doesn't necessarily mean they're going to all turn red, but it does mean that you have to put the fire on, for full blast. You might want to open a window when you do it, and let it burn for 40 minutes. Let me just see how they say it here in the OU guide here. Eroy, okay, interesting. Oh no, sorry. I know it didn't make any sense. They don't have a stove here. Oh, here it is. Which, I don't know why, it's not next to the stove, but okay. Stovetop surface and grates should be cleaned well and not used for 24 hours, right? Similar to a non-self-cleaning oven, right? Because you're not going to be able to get 850 degrees on your grates, and therefore it's going to be considered libun kal, not libun gamor. So for the grates of the stovetop, you should cover it with foil. This is what some people do. This is not according to everybody. But according to the OU, what you should do is cover it with some kind of metal, in which case it will allow the fire to really get to the grates, and it won't sort of dissipate in the air. This is dangerous also for ovens. A family member of mine broke their stove last year, because they did this. They covered it to the extent that there was no way for the air to get out. And you know those little, I don't know what they're called, little rubber gaskets that help you ignite when you turn the gas on, right? There's a little spark that comes out of these little rubber pieces. Those can melt and will break your stove. So you don't want to heat it up to, and it, I mean,
no,
it's obviously
a starter. It's the starter.
Right, the starter spark plug, whatever you want to call it. those can melt if they're at very high temperatures. So you don't want to necessarily cover it to the extent that it's going to keep all the heat in. You still want to have, you know, but it's obviously made to be hot, right? It's not like one of those things. I had a different family member who once bought a snowblower and then realized that it was a plug-in snowblower and said, oh, I can't use this. It's electrical. Now, obviously, the snowblower is made for snow. So even though it's electrical, it's made to be put in the snow, so you don't have to worry about it. So too here, that little rubber piece is made to be in hot temperatures, so you don't have to worry about actually doing this process, but you do have to worry about adding to the process and making it even hotter than it's supposed to be. So in this case, you can cover it in order to make sure that the heat stays within the general vicinity. Not all kosher agencies will tell you to do that. The OU is saying to do that here, to cover it to the extent that it can burn. This is saying for an hour. I also saw 40 minutes. I guess either one would be okay. The point is to get it extremely hot for an extended period of time, 40 minutes or so, to make it red hot. And this also, again, as a reminder, is only after you've cleaned it and waited 24 hours. Yeah, Paula?
I have stainless steel that goes right on top of it for Pesach.
You mean you keep it on there for Pesach the whole time?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is another option. If you don't want to go through the koshering of your grates, so you can just keep it covered. You should still clean it. Just in case, you know, just to make sure. But
I have the holes for the burners, and the burners go in each one.
Oh, so you still have to clean the grates.
Yeah,
okay. So you're not talking about covering the grates completely. You're talking about covering underneath the grates, which we haven't gotten to.
Thank you. I put different ones in.
Oh. Okay, so then that's completely different. That's like Esther was saying. Okay, so after the grates, the bottom of the grates, meaning underneath the grates, sort of the, I guess you would call it the top of the stove, also has to be thoroughly cleaned, and preferably those can't be koshered because, I mean, unless you have a blowtorch. The heat that you're going to put up for the grates is not going to extend also to the top of the oven, at least according to most, and therefore you should...
Bowl. What you're talking about is the bowl.
Maybe it's called the bowl, according to some. So the underneath the grates.
Like drip pans.
That's what it is.
The drip pan, right.
Okay, the drip pan, whatever you're going to call it. So you should keep that. You should preferably cover that with tinfoil. Most people will do that. You can... alternatively, you can burn it with a blowtorch if you want, but I wouldn't recommend it.
The drip pans are usually pretty available.
If you want to replace it, have a special Pesach one, that's even better.
Except for that.
What about a glass stovetop? Unfortunately, you cannot kosher a glass stovetop. Glass cannot be koshered. Glass cannot be koshered. Doesn't matter if that's a bowl. It doesn't matter if that is your stovetop. It cannot be koshered. It has to be covered. How you can cover it, however, is based on recommendations, because some, it could be dangerous if you're going to cover it and create sort of like too much heat on the glass. The glass can crack, and that's dangerous. So there are different, I think you can find online different types of coverings that will suffice for a glass stovetop if you have one of those situations. So you can reach out and we can figure out what the best way to do that is. I think it's relatively rare to have a glass stovetop, at least around here. I haven't seen any, but nonetheless, that's stovetops. Now let's get to appliances. Jennifer, you want me to do Becher's first? I know Jennifer asked me a question. Like,
what about like electric coils?
So electric coils
is good.
Okay, electric coils is the same thing. You're just going to put it at the high temperature for about 40 minutes. Make sure it gets red hot, and make sure that you cleaned it beforehand. Right, same thing. Hold on. Yeah, same thing. It's going to be a little different. It's going to look different than the gas powered ones, because the gas powered ones are going to have a flame underneath it and you can see the fire. For the electrical ones, I think the electrical ones remind me of, let me know if I'm wrong. I think the electrical ones actually get red. Do they not? So for that, when they get red, so then you start your timer for 40 minutes, and that will burn off whatever's on there. I've never had electrical ones, except for that self-clean oven I told you about in Kansas, which broke, so I never used the electrical ones anyway, so I can't tell you how that works for Pesach. But I believe that's true, and once you get red hot, then you do 40 minutes. Okay, let's talk about items, right? We'll talk about items first. You've got your favorite becher, you've got your favorite knife, you've got your favorite silverware. How can you kosher it? So this is what we got. What we said before was called hagala. Hagala is where you put something in the water. So what do you do to kosher these things? Get a big pot. Ideally, it's a pot that's already kosher for Pesach. If you haven't turned your kitchen over and you're stressed out about, you know, bringing your Pesach stuff out into the atmosphere of the chametz household, so then you can use any pot you want, to be honest. What you're going to do is you're going to fill up the pot, and there are wonderful videos about this also that people can find online. You're going to fill up your pot very, very hot, right? Boil it to what they call a rolling boil. I'm not much of a cook, but apparently that means when the bubbles are rolling, you know. You want to get it that hot, and then you're going to, one by one, carefully, with safe, you know, protocols, whatever, you're going to put whatever you want into that water, which is boiling. If while you're putting, and some will tell you to put it in and then dump it out, or to take it out right away with tongs or something like that. Some will tell you to put everything in and then dump all of it out. If you're going to put everything in and then dump it out only after you're finished koshering everything, so then you're going to have to watch out for making sure the water is continuously boiling. Because sometimes if you put a bunch of things into the water, it'll cool down the water. And therefore, you'll have to wait until it gets to a full boil again in order to kosher it. That might not be so recommended if you're dealing with something which is more of a delicate material. Let's say it's your becher, which you know can bend and melt easier. So you might want to do that quickly. Put it in for 10 seconds. Take it out with the tongs, and then move on with your other stuff. You're going to want to put that in, and then right after you take it out, you want to rinse it with cold water. Whatever it is, you're going to want to rinse it with cold water right afterwards in order for safety and also to finish the koshering process. Better for that, I don't believe you have to wait 24 hours, like we said, because typically those things are already 24 hours, but generally I don't think you have to wait 24 hours anyway. Yeah, so it says here you shouldn't have used it for 24 hours, which is not so relevant, especially when you're talking about silverware and you're talking about bechers. Those are usually not used in the last 24 hours when you kosher them. So technically, you should clean them off, wait 24 hours, or have them clean for 24 hours, and then put them in the boiling water. This is different from tefillah. Remember when I said about 25 minutes ago that when it comes to dipping something in a mikvah, so you have to make sure that the entire thing is submerged and enveloped by the water at one moment. That's not the case when it comes to koshering. When it comes to koshering, it doesn't all have to be in the water at one time. So for instance, you might ask me a question, how can I kosher the top of my pot, right? The pot cover is a big cylindrical disc, and when you put it in the water, it doesn't all fit in the water. So what you'll do is you'll boil up your water, rolling boil. You'll put the top in sideways, like vertically, right? You'll put it in vertically, and then slowly you'll move it around. You'll move it around so that every inch of the cover is actually submerged in the water at some point, not altogether, but at some point. So the same goes for anything else. If you have a long spoon that you're trying to hold, if you have a long knife, if you have anything that doesn't fit in the water, as long as every inch of it is at some point in the water, that's good enough for koshering. So that's anything that's small. What about iroi kli rishon? So iroi kli rishon, as we said before, is when you're taking something which is, you're taking hot water and you're pouring it onto something else. What do you use that for? So if you have stone countertops, can be koshered with Iroi Kli Rishon. I was just talking to Mincy today about her countertops. There's another way to do this with a steamer, but it gets more complicated. So it's not really something people have available. I'm trying to find here the materials of the countertops. I I'm not seeing it here. Suffice it to say that here. Oh, wow. This is a big list. Here's the CRC's list of different countertops. I didn't even know that there were this many countertops. But your classic ones, like Korian could be kashered. That's a big machlokas, because Korian is the type of material that does develop scratches and nicks inside of it. If you have scratches and sort of cracks inside of your countertop where there could be food inside of it, and you can't access the food, you can't clean it out, so that part has to be covered. That can't be kashered. Otherwise, you can kasher Korian. Let's see what else. Other people obviously know. Granite can be koshered through Iroi Kli Rishon. I don't even know what some of these things are. Formica can be koshered, but you also have to make sure to get the seams. Formica has a lot of seams, so that could also be a problem depending on what your countertop looks like. Plastic laminate can actually be koshered, but you have to clean out the seams. Marble can be koshered. Porcelain cannot be koshered. Again, porcelain is more like earthenware. It cannot be koshered. It has to be covered. Quartz. There are different types of quartz. Most quartz can be koshered. That shouldn't be a problem. Let's see here. Stainless steel can be koshered, as you could probably guess. Wood is difficult because oftentimes wood has cracks and scratches. That has to be covered. If it's brand new wood, so maybe it's able. Acrylic can be koshered if there are no scratches and things like that. So most things can be koshered. Things that can't be koshered are ceramic tile or concrete. Let's see what else did they have here. Glass tile. Never even seen that before. Those types of things that aren't able to be koshered. How do you kosher it with Iroi Kli Rishon? First of all, you want to get a lot of towels, because it's going to be a messy process. Get a lot of towels, put it under the bridge or under the lip of the counter, and you're going to want to pour the boiling hot water, whether that's from a kettle, whether that's from an urn, whether it's from a pot. Be very careful, obviously take precautions. You're going to want to cover, to touch every single spot of your countertop. Also important to remember, when you do this, you have to maintain, and this is a little difficult, you know, take some practice maybe, but you have to maintain a solid stream from the pot onto the countertop. If the stream is broken in midair, so it's as if it's not from a Kli Rishon, or according to some, it's as if it's not from a Kli Rishon, it's not from the original heated pot, and therefore it would not be koshering the item when it hits it. So you have to make sure, and that doesn't mean that you have to continuously pour out the water the whole time. That just means that when the water hits the countertop, it has to still be connected to the pot. You can stop it, but it still has to be connected. That can be tricky. So, and depending how big your counter is, obviously you're going to have to heat up a lot of water or less water. It depends what it is. So that's countertops. There are other types of things that technically would be something you put inside of a pot, but you just can't disconnect it. So for instance, your kitchen sink is the type of thing that most people would not want to try to detach and then reattach. So instead, you can do Iroi Kli Rishon on the kitchen sink in the same way. You're going to pour it onto the handles. You're going to pour it onto the sink. A couple things about sinks, however, faucets in specific. The end of it, sometimes it's called an aerator, sometimes it's called a filter. You can unscrew that piece if it's the type of thing you don't really need for the functionality of your sink. So people will say that you just don't use it for Pesach or you replace it for Pesach. Some people will say that you can kosher it if it's sort of a piece of plastic. I would say to clean it out, to clean it as best as you can, and then do Iroi Kli Rishon on it. And that could also, by the way, you could also, because the faucet comes down like this, you could also do a type of Haggalah where you just take the boiling pot of water and put it up so that the faucet is inside of the pot. That's a little more complicated or a little more skillful. So you might not want to do that, but it's hard. You have to somehow get the underside of the faucet. So somehow either through the pot or through unscrewing it, you have to pour boiling water or put it in boiling water in order to kosher it. And some people say you can't use it at all, but I think we can be lenient to do that. What else? Any questions? I'm sure there are a lot of questions. Individual types of things.
We have a water filter attached to the faucet. Can we use that water filter? It's a kind of sealed unit. Every 6 months, you put a new cartridge in.
If it's something like a renewable one, so then and all you do is put water through it. So the only concern you're going to have is the opening of it. Think about it this way. Well, the concern we have with faucets is that when you are washing your dishes or when you are putting your colander with your noodles inside of the sink, so those fumes or that hot water is going to connect back to the sink. So we're worried about that piece. So this, I'm assuming this is plastic?
Yes, it's a plastic.
Yeah, so the plastic, you're going to want to treat the end of it just like you would treat the sink. You'd have to kosher it. There is a machlokas about koshering plastic. For this type of thing, we can be lenient because it's very rare that you're actually going to get chametz in that piece of plastic. So do this type of koshering. I would say to replace the filter. Because I know the filter gets full of a lot of schmutz somehow, some way, the minerals or whatever. That's what I would say. If I see otherwise, then I'll let you know, but I'm pretty sure that would be okay. Let's say hot water urn. Hot water urn. Some people might be asking about a hot water urn. The hot water urn. What, Jennifer?
I'm sorry. When you say hot water urn, are you talking about like an instant hot that's connected to your sink? Or are you talking about like the pump pot?
So I was talking about the pump pot, but if you're talking about the instant hot that you're talking that's connected to your sink, that you treat just like your faucet.
Okay.
The same way. Okay. And when it comes to the pump pot or your kettle or whatever it is, you have to somehow kosher that. So what you're going to do is you're going to bring it up. If you haven't used it in a while, you're going to fill it with water, bring it to a boil, and then you're going to want to do the same thing you did to your faucet, also to the spigot of the hot water urn. That's all you have to do, because really, assuming that all you used it for was water, there's no other schmutz in there that you have to be worried about. Any other question? What other questions? Microwaves. Let's talk about microwaves. We said before that you cannot kosher glass. So what do you do with a microwave? Well, you either have to get another piece of glass or you have to not use that glass. The turntable in the middle. So you cannot use that on Pesach. We assume that it's chametz stick and we assume you can't kosher it. In which case you have to take it out, put it somewhere else. You still have to, however, clean out the microwave. So what you're going to do for a microwave is you're going to wipe it down, clean it out. Usually it's not that much schmutz unless you made a real big accident in there. You're going to clean it out. And you're going to put a cup of water inside of the microwave, turn it on high heat for 10 minutes, allow those the steam of the water to basically cover the whole sides, and then you're good to go. It is still, however, recommended that you cover anything you put inside the microwave, lest there might be some schmutz in the microwave. But generally, microwaves are more lenient because of how they operate and how things are heated up. Refrigerators. No need to do anything fancy with refrigerators. Clean it out, wipe it down, but you don't have to pour anything inside of it. Again, as we introduced the koshering process, the only thing that you have to take out is the way that things are put in, right? So when it comes to a refrigerator, it's cold, so nothing's going to absorb. Technically, nothing's going to absorb into the sides or into the shelves, so you don't have any requirement to actually put anything hot there, because that's not how anything would have been absorbed in there. And therefore, all you have to do is clean it out, make sure there are no crumbs, so that it doesn't touch any other food and ultimately end up in your mouth over Pesach. You can cover them if you want. Some people like to cover their shelves just out of a concern. But there's no, and that's that goes the same for your pantry. You just have to wipe it down. Some people like to cover it either with paper or with some kind of sticky, whatever it's called, contact paper. That you do not have to do, but it makes people more comfortable that you can do that. You do have to do that forever. However, for like a high chair, a baby. I have babies. I don't know what they're called. a high chair or some kind of booster seat that has its own table, you're going to want to cover that with contact paper, because that's the type of thing, especially with the scratches, and especially because you put food directly on it, you're going to want to clean it, clean the whole thing, really, and put contact paper on it so that it's completely covered, because there could definitely be vestiges of chametz in there. Yeah, Jeff?
Like Keurig is the same thing for the hot water urn as far as just putting...
I would assume, let me read it here. The OU has a piece on that. Let me just read it for you. The coffee maker must be cleaned well and not used for 24 hours like we did for other things. Remove the K-cup holder and perform Haggalah or Eroi on the K-cup holder. Run a kosher for Passover K-cup in the machine. Oh, interesting. So there are elements on the inside that you can't get to unless you actually run the thing. So you have to I don't know if it's water or tea, something that's not chametz, you have to actually run a cycle through it so that it can also kasher that with hot water, right? Because that's what you're putting through it. So that's how you would do it. This is only according to those who kasher plastic. We can be lenient to kasher plastic, especially for a Keurig, where it's not really going to have real chametz in it. Any other questions? What else?
I had a question.
Yeah, Kathy.
We have one of those faucets that you can pull down the front with the sprayer.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do about that, like, plasticky cord?
Is it made of, is it plastic?
It's like a rubber gasket kind of material, I think. It's not metal.
I would say to not use it over Pesach. Clean it out.
Okay.
If you want
to. So we can kosher the faucet in the same way without having to worry about that part of it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I've seen different agencies say different things. Some say that you can kosher those things, and some say that you can't, and you should just not use it over Yontif. What else? Trying to see here what they have in the OU. Dishwashers, we say, tough luck. Tables, you should clean off your tables, especially the ones with crevices that you can't get to. You should cover them, either a plastic covering or a tablecloth of some kind, and that should be good enough. Warming drawers are no go. You can't kosher warming drawers. You got to use your regular oven in the way that we said before. The sink itself, we said just like the countertops, you can do Eroi Kli Rishon. If your sink is metal, so you can stainless steel, you can do the same thing. It's a little more complicated because you have to get the sides, right? So you have to have something which can go at an angle, or you have to shoot it at an angle so that the hot water directly hits the sides of and all aspects of it. The drain, if it has little holes that you can't clean out properly, so you're going to use a different drain for Yontif. What else for the sink? There are other people that say you have to do an Evan Milubenes, but we're not going to do that. You don't have to do that. Just do it with Eroi Kli Rishon. If you have a ceramic sink, you have a porcelain sink, you cannot kosher it. As we said before, with other porcelain things, you cannot kosher it. You have to get some kind of insert, some kind of covering that prevents you from using it on or directly touching it on Yontif. Anything else? Kashering, did we cover everything? Sandy, it looks like you have something to say, or Jerry, it looks like you have something to say, but I can't hear you.
Okay, what about garbage disposals?
Garbage disposals?
In the sink. What do we do about that, or do we have to do anything about it?
Well, I assume the garbage disposal is after it's already gone through, right?
Well, no.
I don't think you have to do anything with garbage disposal, because it's not accessible.
Okay.
I don't think. I've never seen anything about that.
Well, yeah. Don't use it.
Yeah. What else? Anything else? Dina?
Yeah, I was at the Kaylee Mikvah once a couple of years ago, and there was a guy there with a huge box of disposable pans.
Yeah, good question.
Good question.
I'll tell you a story that my wife loves to tell, but it's a story that I personally don't like to tell, which is that when I was in Rav Herschel Schechter's shir, he quoted this, it's machlokas, because technically it's metal, right? And anything that's metal is mekabel tumah, and therefore it also is relevant for this type of thing. However, something which is temporary and is not permanent is not mekabel tumah. So in the end of the day, the only types of metal that you're going to have to kasher are the ones that you're going to continuously use. So some people will reuse their aluminum pans. if you're going to reuse your aluminum pans for a consistent amount, you should kosher them. You should tovel them. If you're not planning on using them again, meaning that you use it once and you throw it out, so then you don't have to tovel them. However, and this is where the story comes in, Rav Schechter said to his wife, it's a machlokes, and Rebbetzin Schechter said, I'm going to be lenient, and she never tovels her pans, and Rav Schechter doesn't put up a fight for Sholem Bias. My wife likes to tell that story, but really, you should tovel them if you need to. If you're planning on using them on a consistent basis, reusing them. The same thing, by the way, for like a Snapple bottle. Like at least it used to be the Snapple bottles were glass. Used to be that everything was glass. You know, Coca-Cola came in a glass. So the question is, wait a second, you have to tovel glass. So the same thing, if you're only using it once and you're throwing it out, so then you don't have to tovel it. But if you're going to use it, like one of my brothers, I don't know if my bubby knows this, but one of my brothers loved drinking out of a Snapple glass. It was Donnie. And Donnie used to drink out of a Snapple, and then he would finish it, and then he would fill it up with water and put it back in the fridge. If that's how you're going to use a Snapple or anything else that's glass, you should really tovel it. I don't know if he did, because he was young. But that's really, if you're using it on a permanent basis, those types of things, which are typically temporary, you do have to tovel them if you're not using them in a temporary way. Okay, anything else? We did Bechers, we did a bunch of different things. By the way, if you have... Right? What did you say?
Warming trays.
Warming trays are a no-go. You can't use warming trays. Yeah. Just a nuance about koshering pots and pans and things like that. If you have some kind of vessel that has little nooks and crannies, just like we said by the countertops, that you can't kosher it because you can't get to those nooks and crannies. If you have like a lip on your pot, sometimes you have like a pot that has a curl at the end, and there are crevices inside that lip you can't get to, so then you're not able to kosher it. Much like you can't kosher those parts of the countertop, in which case you shouldn't use those. If you have something with handles, so technically, and you want to kosher that pot, you should really unscrew the handles and kosher that part separately, clean it out and kosher that part separately, which gets a little tedious. Anything else? Any other questions? Individual things, when you get to it, maybe you haven't actually koshered yet, that's why you're listening to this class. When you get to actually koshering things and you have questions, so obviously I'm here and available for anything you need. Next week, hopefully, we'll talk about the actual process of Tanis Bechorim. We'll talk about the Erev Pesach on Shabbos, Shal Shudis, the timing of Kol Chamira, how do you get rid of your chametz, and we'll talk about the Seder, halachas of what your Mara should look like, what your Charoset should look like. My Bubby could really tell us all about that also. But suffice it to say, we'll keep that for next week on Wednesday night. Thank you all for joining me next Wednesday night, 7 o'clock for part 2. And if you have any questions, let me know your individual stories. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Everyone should have Chag Kasher V'Sameach.
Okay.